Hello and welcome to the Blackstone Podcast, our channel dedicated to the insights, conversations, and news from across our firm. I'm Will Pollack, Vice President in Public Affairs. Today, I'm speaking with Tom Hill, President and CEO of Blackstone Alternative Asset Management. Tom recently wrote an op-ed on how hedge funds can be built to last. We're sitting down with Tom to discuss the pressures facing hedge funds today and how these organizations should think differently about the long term. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Okay, here we go.
To start, for our listeners, could you talk a little bit about how the hedge fund space has evolved over time and where it's at today?
Well, going back to 1990, hedge funds comprised about $40 billion of AUM. Today, they're $3.4 trillion of assets under management. It's become a global business. There are over 10,000 hedge funds. Back in the 70s and 80s, it was largely a domain for high net worth individuals to invest, and also some endowments and foundations. Now it has become an institutional marketplace where the largest sovereign wealth funds, central banks, and pension plans around the world have exposure.
In your recent op-ed, you compared the hedge fund space to a memorable scene in Monty Python. What was the point you're trying to get at?
Well, I don't know if you recall the scene where a villager is being, you know, thrown onto the back of a cart, and he cries out, "Hey, I'm not dead yet!" And for about the last 3 years, hedge funds have been under attack. The assets under management stalled at roughly the $3 trillion level. And the combination of low returns and high fees was rather toxic. And for several years, the industry only produced returns of about 6 to 7% gross. And when you're charging 1.5 and 20, that doesn't work for the investors. For the last 12 months, hedge funds, they're back into levels of returns where there's less direct pressure on fees, but it's still an ongoing concern, in part because in a zero interest rate environment where there's low volatility because of financial repression, typically hedge funds earn a rate of return over the risk-free rate.
And to navigate that environment, these businesses need to innovate and they need to diversify. What does that evolution look like? And tie that specifically to the idea of succession planning.
I think the approach that most investors who decide to actually get into the hedge fund space take is, I've got a skill set and I want to actually practice my trade in the hedge fund space because it gives me the best tools to be able to manage money in the most efficient way. And depending upon what asset class you're in, whether it's equities, fixed income, commodities, macro, quant, you actually can dial up or down your exposure depending upon your risk management and your view of where the market is at any particular point in time. So talented investors historically have said, I want to practice my trade in the most efficient vehicle possible, which is hedge funds. And many people misconstrue that hedge funds are an asset class, when in fact they are just a way of managing money, whether it's in equities or in fixed income or in credit, long and short. Historically, hedge funds were paid on the basis of their returns through their incentive fees. And in the 80s and 90s, all of the great hedge fund managers produced great returns and therefore were able to benefit themselves by sharing through a 20% incentive fee in those returns that they generated for their LPs. Now, as the industry grew, there became much more focus on managing assets. And so the management fee, rather than concentrating on generating the returns, hedge funds began to say, let's think about AUM and let's actually think about reducing risk. And because they had virtually 100% of their money in the hedge fund, there was also a natural tendency to think about reducing risk. So that's one of the reasons, in addition to the zero interest rate environment, why hedge funds' returns have come down over the last 5 to 10 years, which is a misalignment of incentives. And what hedge funds typically do is they reach a point where it just ends. The hedge fund manager says, I'm done. I'm going to hang up my spurs and I'm not going to continue anymore. And the hedge fund typically closes. The question today is whether hedge funds can actually build businesses that create a going concern. Because from an LP standpoint, it is very hard every 10 or 15 years to re-underwrite new talent that come in. Wouldn't it be great if, in fact, the founder was able to transition the business to the next generation? And just like Blackstone, which will continue just as Pete Peterson has retired, at some point, all of the senior management of Blackstone will no longer be here, and we have the next generation to take over. The purpose of my op-ed piece was to raise the issue that hedge funds have to be thinking about how to create going concern value. And rather than having the strategy be a product of one individual who came up with a good idea, who could manage the money in the most flexible way, to create a group of people who can share the ideals, share the strategy and the depth of the research and the organization and the culture to be able to create a going concern.
And what does that going concern look like? What are the components that you think will make hedge funds more sustainable for the long term?
Well, I ask every hedge fund manager that we interview, how do you think about your share of the economics in the hedge fund versus what you're prepared to actually share with your colleagues? And if the hedge fund manager has maintained over 50% and has been unwilling to actually dilute himself below the 50%, that is a warning signal that maybe, you know, this particular individual doesn't want to create the next generation of talent to succeed him.
As you think about how the next generation will look at hedge funds as a strategy, where are you seeing sources of innovation or diversification?
There's one common denominator to those hedge funds that have created going concern value, and that's their ability to put themselves in the heads of their investors, to get into what the investors need, and then to respond through innovation to create either new strategies or to create a way to fulfill the expectations of the investors. And those investors that constantly innovate and have that kind of partnership with their investors, where they know what their investors want and then can reverse engineer to give it to them, are those that typically succeed.
And is that innovation through investment strategy or fee structure? What are some of the ways that funds are thinking differently about meeting investors' needs?
I think it's a whole range of ways to meet investor needs. Clearly, if you can create additional streams of revenue for yourself, where at the same time you give your investors, let's say for your best ideas, an access to a position where you have, for diversification reasons, limited it to, let's say, 10 or 12%, but you know it's your best idea. Well, what you can do is create structures where you permit your investors to benefit from that one position by lifting that out, you create it for your investor, and we've done this in numerous instances. We bring it onto our balance sheet, it becomes our asset, and essentially the hedge fund doesn't need to get paid his historical fees of, let's say, 1.5 and 20, because the research has already been done. There's already a sunk cost around doing the work of coming up with that idea. The idea already exists in the portfolio of the hedge fund, and we as the investor get the benefit of that position, that idea, and we're prepared to pay, let's say, a modest management fee and some incentive fee, perhaps over a hurdle rate, to get that one particular exposure that we think is the best idea in that hedge fund's portfolio. So in that instance, it's win-win. It's a win for the hedge fund because they develop an incremental source of revenue over an idea that they already have in their book, but they can't grow to a bigger position because of diversification limits. And we, the investor, get the benefit of that idea at a lower cost. So it's often one where it's taking an existing idea and then creating a new structure that's creative and a new fee structure to give a benefit. But it can also be in completely a new area where essentially some of our quantitative strategies are constantly thinking about ways that they can use data to actually transform what has been a historical way of investing or underwriting or doing business, and using data to create a better mousetrap, in effect, a better product.
Thinking about the role of technology, technology has evolved so immensely over the past 10, even 5 years in terms of big data. As you think about founders, especially founders that are later in their careers, how are they adapting to this new reality to ensure that the fund can take advantage of opportunities?
Well, I think investors, by definition, have to be curious. When you're investigating an idea, you have to be willing to pull on all sorts of threads. And today, if you don't factor in how data can help you get to better answers, then you're missing a whole new component. One example in their strategies gets each day over 2 million signals, and it can be from satellite technology, satellites that they have circling the Earth, where they can see traffic in malls. They can actually identify if it's in fact a mall in the Midwest where there's a parking lot and cars are in the parking lot and it's been snowing, whether there's actually snow on the car or whether it's an empty parking lot and the snow's on the ground. They have a high level of sophistication to be able to break down data, turn it into useful information that can actually make better investment decisions. So one of the reasons that institutions did better than individuals in investing in the stock market was, first, they had better research. Second, they had it earlier. Today, with Bloomberg, you have a lot of that comparative advantage arbed away because you can get the information really thorough and really quickly, you know, through technology. So hedge funds have to actually be on the cutting edge of where to get the most useful information and also the value-added information quicker. And data often is the answer to that.
In your mind, what are some of the lessons you think other organizations could learn from the way you've structured both the culture and the processes at BAM to ensure that long-term continuity and culture of innovation?
Well, I brought to BAM in 2000 the same philosophy that I had when I ran banking at various investment banks before I joined Blackstone. And the question is, what does your customer want? In this case, What does your investor want? A little bit like going to a doctor. The doctor's first question is, well, how do you feel? Do you have a headache? What's going on? You have to actually get inside the head of the investor. The second thing you have to do is make sure that you have the ability to create something that meets the investor needs. First, to understand the needs, but then to be able to give the investor what they want. And in hedge funds, back in the 1990s, because they were geared to high net worth individuals, what a lot of allocators to the space did was take a product geared to an individual and simply put a new coat of paint on it and said, oh, I'm going to sell this to the institutions. And in fact, the institutions wanted something customized, wanted something built to suit, wanted something that would actually meet their risk return parameters rather than the one size fits all that, would often appeal to individual investors, high net worth investors. So in 2000, what we did at BAM was said, we're going to take a customized solution approach where we're going to go to the big investors, ask them what they want, then say we're going to reverse engineer to give them what they want, and it's going to be customized. And I have to say, one of the absolute measures of not just our success at BAM, but also the fact that we have going concern value, is that each year over the last 10 years, more than 50% of the money that we raise comes from existing investors giving us more money. So that means we have satisfied customers, we have met the investor expectations, and they keep giving us more money.
Excellent. Tom, thank you so much for your time. This is totally fascinating and very, very insightful.
Thank you, Will. Appreciate being here.
Neither this podcast nor any of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or instrument in or to participate in any trading strategy with any Blackstone fund or other investment vehicle. Past performance is not indicative of any future results, and there's no assurance that any Blackstone fund will achieve its objectives or avoid significant losses. This podcast may contain forward-looking statements. Such statements are subject to various risks and uncertainties.